The idea here is so we have this ADS CFT correspondence, and as I mentioned yesterday, there's been a remarkable formula that most of you are now familiar with that suggests a connection between entanglement structure in the field theory side and geometrical structure on the gravity side. Okay. So in this talk, I'm basically going to assume that we're talking about some conformal field theory for which at least a family of the states have gravity duals. And I'm going to assume that this formula by Ryu and Takinagi and then a covariant generalization which was due to Hubini, Rangamani, and Takinagi. So I'll assume that this formula that I'll review to start is true, and then the idea is what we're going to try to use that to derive some things that are generally true about the corresponding theories of gravity. Okay. So I think the things that I'll say are potentially very, very general. It's been argued that if you took any consistent theory of quantum gravity so in anti-de Sitter space or describing space times that are asymptotically anti-de Sitter, that you could use such a theory to define a conformal field theory. And so what we're going to do is use things that are true about all conformal field theories. Use this formula and then understand the consequences of those things on the gravity side. Okay, so potentially the things that we're going to derive would apply to absolutely any theory of quantum gravity. So if these things are true, regardless of whether it's coming from string theory or whatever. So let me just start by reviewing this Ryu Takinagi formula. So we know what we're talking about. Okay, so the idea is that we've got a conformal field theory on some some fixed space-time B, and we can consider some particular state of that field theory. And so remember, our assumption is that this is a field theory with a gravity dual. So we'll assume that we're talking about a state that corresponds to some particular classical geometry, M, and then you could go on and consider quantum fields living on that geometry, but for this talk, I'm basically going to be working in the classical limit. So this is going to be some large N CFT. No, not necessarily.
What I'm saying is that you might start with the classical state psi, and
Yeah.
if it's not in equilibrium state, it will be evolving. So maybe during the evolution,
Well, I mean, let's. So there's lots of dynamical solutions to classical gravity equations, and they should correspond to some states that would be time dependent. So there, I mean, there may be things where you have some initial data that causes a black hole to form or
So
something.
I guess you're going to assume that you're always going to use two derivative gravity no matter what happens, whether or not curvature. some parts get blocked. Because you are saying you're going to use a CFT, right? So the CFT has nothing to do with gravity. So in particular, CFT incorporates this one over m or higher order correction. And so something that's well defined over there.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm going to be using, okay, so what I'm going to be doing is working essentially with large n, with the leading large n quantities on this side and relating them to classical things on this side. And then one could go on and look at corrections. In terms of the higher, so with higher derivative, this Ryutaki Nagi formula that I'm going to write down, there's versions of that should work for higher derivative gravity, but I'm in this talk going to be working with a version that is probably true for theories whose classical limit is Einstein gravity coupled to matter. Okay, so that's I guess the context. Okay, so we're going to learn things about, say, quantum theories of consistent theories of gravity whose classical limit is Einstein gravity coupled to matter. Yeah, or we could. We'll see. You know, we could say things about physics close to the boundary where things, you know, if you get close enough to the boundary, then it goes back to pure ADS. So if there's something funny happening, it's usually deeper in the bulk. Okay, so let me review this formula. So this is the context. We've got a state. It's dual to some space-time. It's not necessarily static or stationary or anything. The space-time here is asymptotically ADS. And the boundary geometry is the same as the geometry on which the field theory lives. Okay. And so the claim is that if I now consider a region on the boundary, A, and compute the entanglement entropy of the region A, then this should be equal, okay, so to the following quantity on the gravity side. You take the corresponding region on the boundary of your spacetime M, you construct a surface A tilde in the bulk, which is an extremum of the area functional. Okay, where by area we mean the volume of this codimension to surface. And then that entanglement entropy is supposed to be the area of A tilde over 4 times the Newton constant in the bulk. Okay, and there are some there's some refinements of this that won't come up. So if, for example, if there's multiple surfaces that are extremal, then you're supposed to choose the one with the least area. The surface A tilde is supposed to be homologous to A in the bulk, but we won't really need to use those. Okay, so. So I'll just call this RT, although the generalization to non-static space times, where you're talking about an extremal of the area functional rather than a minimum, was due to Hubini and Rangamani and Takanagi. So mathematically speaking, this formula you can think of as relating two different spaces of things. So I want to consider, I'll draw this. So this is asymptotically ADS spacetimes geometries. With boundary B. And over here I'm going to draw a higher dimensional space. So I guess I'll draw that's supposed to look two-dimensional. This is three, where two stands for infinity and three stands for a bigger infinity. So this is supposed to be functions on subsets of B. Okay. So these geometries would fit in here somewhere, and the possible entanglement structures for a field theory would fit in this space somewhere. And the Ryutaki and Nagi formula, it kind of basically gives you a map from here to here. So if I have an asymptotically ADS geometry, okay, then using Ryutaki and Nagi, that will give me one of these functions, because now I can choose a subset of B, find the extremal surface, and find its area, and then that gives me a number. Okay. I'm deciding whether to say, okay. So maybe I'll say one comment. This is infinite and this is infinite. If we wanted to talk about something finite, for some reason, you could define this function to be so. One thing you can do instead of just talking about the entanglement entropy, you could talk about the entanglement entropy of the state minus the entanglement entropy of the vacuum state. So this is one way to talk about entanglement entropies of different field theory states and talk about something finite. So the divergences here are the same as the divergences here. Okay. All right. So this is sort of a general picture. And so there's two comments that I want to make about this. Okay, so the first one is that this space is a lot smaller than this space.
60% for that format for the difference?
Yeah.
You're still using the same area in B to compute both of those entropies? So
you're still using the same region, yeah. 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 Yeah, so this set is tiny compared to this set. I mean, just to motivate that, to specify something in here, there'd be some finite number of metric functions of some small number of variables. Okay. Whereas in here, you're talking about functions of subsets of a space. Okay. So the number of, and even if we restrict to say sufficiently smooth, and we could talk about, you know, put any conditions, compactness or smoothness or whatever, the number of subsets of this space B is much, much larger than, you know, just the number of functions that I could write down. Okay, so this is a function of some points. This is a function of regions, of arbitrary regions. Okay, and the number of points is clearly much smaller than the number of regions. I think that's not particularly relevant for this. So here I'm just saying, yeah. I mean, here I'm simply saying that I can label points by these coordinates, and then here I've got you know, much more general subsets of a space. Okay, so because this is much smaller than this, when you map it over, it's going to map into some measure zero, I mean some tiny subset of this space. Okay, and so the way we want to think of this space is these are like possible. So what are these functions on subsets of B? These are the entanglement structures of the field theory. Okay, so these are possible entanglement structures. Okay, so if I just have a field theory in a particular state and I compute all the entanglement entropies, that puts me somewhere in here. Okay, and so if I have a state which is holographic and where I can compute the entanglement entropies using this Ryutaki-Nagi formula, I'm certainly not going to be able to map into arbitrary points here. It's going to be a tiny subset. And so this is, I guess, the first interesting point here that, let me see, I'm going to work over here. So one, only very special functions on, so only very special entanglement structures will be obtained in this way. Okay. So let me give you. So I think it's very interesting to understand what kind of entanglement structure for a field theory state would admit such a geometrical description. Okay. So let me just give you a sense of how constraining this is. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
But there is much more that we can do in the gravity set, right? So even though normally we don't talk about that, but we can add operators. We can add some lot of scalar fields and just turn on normalizable components of that. And there are infinite set of basically whatever the tower operators we have in CFT. And so we can create, there is a, I would say, an infinity of possibilities that I can construct the state. And so presumably, if I allow additional scalar fields also inside, only with normalizable components turned on, I will have more access into what entanglement I can map.
Well, the formula here only refers to the metric. So it's absolutely true that there's lots of possible physics. So there's certainly more than the geometry, okay? But in the end, whatever state you have, there's going to be a geometry there. And that's the only thing that comes into the entanglement.
So you're trying to say that I'm going to probe it only with the Ryutaki-Nagi formula, wherever I don't care how this geometry is constructed, whether there are additional scalar fields that drive it.
Right, they don't really see that.
The only thing that you allow yourself to look at is the entanglement.
Yeah. So that's the context for this. This geometry, which is sort of the universal thing in all the possible theories, that's telling us about the entanglement structure, and there should be some, the fact that you can calculate that and or represent that entanglement structure by a geometry is a very strong constraint on the structure. So I just want to give you a quick example to suggest how constraining that is. So if we consider, what I want to do is consider just a limited number of subsets that would have about the same information as a metric. Okay. So consider just the ball-shaped regions of various center positions and various sizes. So if I only computed the entanglement entropy for these ball-shaped regions, that would give me essentially as much information as a metric function. So S of X, so it depends on the field theory coordinate, which is describing the center of the ball, and it describes, and it's a function of one other object, which is the radius of the ball. So this is about as much information as a metric function. And in fact, perturbatively, if you look at a geometry which is a small perturbation away from ADS, you can show that this information is enough to reconstruct one of the metric functions. Okay, and so a motivation for that is if you look at these surfaces that they're going to use to calculate the entanglement entropies, so there's basically, in pure ADS, before I deform anything, there's a one-to-one correspondence between these balls and points in ADS, and you could just associate the point which is at the tip of this extremal surface, which is going to be a hemisphere. So there's basically as many of these balls as there are points in the bulk. Perturbatively, I could use these balls to construct one of the metric functions. And I think, so I can't prove this, but I suspect it's true, even away from perturbation theory, that that given the information about these areas, you could reconstruct the metric some distance into the bulk. Yeah, so I said that you could get one of the metric functions. So I'll tell you how to get the rest. So at least perturbatively, how you can get the rest is instead of looking at the balls in, say, your original spatial slice, so say we're talking about Minkowski space on the boundary. So when I was talking about all of these balls, I was working in a spatial slice, say this, or some particular spatial slicing. But what I could do is now consider the ball-shaped regions in another frame of reference, so in some other slicing. And then it turns out that that additional information is enough to get the rest of the metric. Again, so this is a statement which is true perturbatively, but again, I suspect that even if it's a general metric, that at least some distance into the bulk you could reconstruct the metric using these balls in different frames of reference. Well, you could have situations where extremal surfaces don't penetrate past a certain point, and one could question whether those geometries are actually physical or not. But it's easy enough to write down a metric where there's a hidden region where you can't probe it using these extremal surfaces.
Are there any signals in these
cases that led to other than geometry? I had a student that investigated a class of boson star geometries, so just a scalar field coupled to a metric, spherically symmetric. He found that so if you had a large enough central value of the scalar field, you could have cases where the extremal surfaces didn't penetrate. And what he found was actually that in those cases, they were always unstable in a sense that there would be two different solutions with the same mass, as far as I remember, and the one that had a barrier to the extremal surfaces was the one that wasn't stable. So I that's just a little piece of evidence. But
thermodynamically,
thermodynamically stable. Yeah. I don't know about the dynamical stability. Okay. So the point is we could look at a very limited set of subsets, calculate these entanglement entropies, reconstruct the geometry at least some distance into the bulk, okay, and then from that, so we go from there to there, that gives us M, and then from that we should be able to should be able to find all of the other extremal surfaces and therefore know all of the other entanglement entropies. Okay, so that suggests that for these special states that have gravity duals, that the entanglement entropy for ball-shaped regions, would allow me to know the entire, the entanglement entropy for arbitrary regions.
So, but if you don't have the metric in the bulk, how would you know how to distinguish the slicing, where you have a convenient slicing or not? If you only have information on the boundary, how do you know how to distinguish the two slices, the one that is convenient and the one that is not?
Well, what I'm saying is that I'm going to compute these. So let's say the boundary is Minkowski space. Okay, so I'm just going to compute these ball-shaped regions for all of the slicings. I could consider in Minkowski space, I have some natural set of slicings. So
the slicing is only at the boundary, or?
Yeah, it's just on the boundary. Yeah. So the only reason I need a slicing is when I'm talking about subsets of the boundary, I work on a spatial slice. So this is very, this is very constrained. In principle, one could try to actually work out a formula for entanglement entropy of general regions in terms of the ball-shaped regions. Okay, I have a student that's working on that. But just more generally, I think an interesting program here is to understand what is the entanglement structure of these field theory states that allows the description through geometry? So that's, what entanglement structure permits geometrical description? And then a reason that you might want to understand this is but then you could try to see why it is that N equals 4 super Yang Mills or other kinds of holographic Hamiltonians, why do they give rise to these kinds of states? Why are the low energy states of those particular Hamiltonians giving you this kind of entanglement structure? H's give the structure. And that would, I think if one can understand that, then you're really understanding why geometry is emerging out of these holographic field theories.
So I guess the idea is that you want to use the entanglement entropy as a proxy to describe the state.
Well, it's a feature of the state. I mean, it's a universal kind of feature.
See, the thing that worries me is that I'm going to implement this program at any instance of time, right? And so I'm going to be able to reconstruct the bulk metric as a function of time. But the thing is that you wouldn't know how to evolve it, right? Why there is this time dependence? You will not be able to predict because, for example, you are not sensitive to whatever scale it uses it, and they might be driving it. So the only thing you look is the geometry. Einstein equations also include all the other stuff. I'm saying there is way more to the state than just looking at its reflection in the bulk metric.
So I agree with that.
How do you know what Hamiltonian I use or even what state? If all you do is just look at the bulk metric, that's what I'm talking about.
So. I mean, I completely agree that there's a lot more physics there. There's a lot more observables than just entanglement. Um, what I'm trying to do is just take a state, and then for any example here, there's some universal thing I can look at, which is the entanglement structure. And so I'm simply asking, I mean, I'm just saying I'm interested in this entanglement structure. Okay, that's not everything about the field theory. And the fact that this Ryu Takayanagi formula works is going to teach me something about that entanglement structure. Okay, and then that could teach me something about the Hamiltonians. It's not going to teach me everything about the field theory, but
maybe if I can rephrase.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it's not one-to-one. It's a very...
Yeah.
I feel like it's very ambiguous. It's very multi-state codes, precisely because you don't look at other observables. It might be that there are lots of states that give rise to the same...
Yeah, so, well, let me talk about an example. I mean, so say... We know that lots of states... In fact, we know that most states, if I talk about a high-energy state, we know that most states are going to look like a black hole, okay, in the bulk. So if I took a typical high-energy state of the field theory on a sphere, I'm going to expect that the bulk geometry looks a lot like a black hole. Okay, so that's an example where there's lots of states, and I may not be able to distinguish those easily using this entanglement. Nevertheless, the fact that there's this black hole geometry will tell me something in detail about the entanglement structure of all of those states. So common to all of those states is a particular entanglement structure. And then then the question would be, well, why is it that that this field theory Hamiltonian makes its energy eigenstates all have that entanglement structure? So why all of these energy eigenstates now have almost exactly the same kind of entanglement structure, and so we should understand why that's true. What's special about that Hamiltonian that gives rise to that? Okay, so that's sort of one direction that we could go in this based on this Ryu Takayanagi formula. But so for the rest of the talk, I want to talk about a different direction. Okay. So the second observation is that if you look at the set of possible functions on subsets, they're not all so independent of whether or not things are coming from geometry. There are constraints on this space, on these functions, in order to be allowable entanglement structures. Okay, so I'll sort of represent that by, I'm going to cut that ball in half and say like these ones on this side are not allowable entanglement structures. So, for example, if I have some subsets A, B and C, so these are just various regions, subsets of my boundary space. Then an example of a constraint that you would have would be strong subadditivity. So that would tell you that S, so these are all disjoint, it would tell you that S of A union B plus S of B union C is greater than or equal to S of B plus S of A union B union C. Okay. So if I choose some general kind of function on the subsets, I might find that this is violated. Okay. And then I would say, well, that function that I just considered is not an allowable entanglement structure for a field theory. Okay. But what might happen is that if I started over here with some particular geometry, what could happen is that using Ryutaki Nagi, I might map it over here and wind up in this disallowed region. Okay. And if that happened, what I would learn, because you know, I can't be in here because that just violates quantum mechanics. So things like strong subadditivity are just absolutely true things that follow, you know, ultimately from linear algebra, properties of matrices. And so it's impossible to have a state that violates this. And so if this geometry is going to come from some consistent state and some consistent theory of quantum gravity, it has to map over and wind up in the allowed region. Okay. So there's then a general program that you could try to carry out, which is to figure out of the set of asymptotically ADS geometries with boundary B, which ones map into the allowed region over here that satisfies all of these kinds of constraints, and which ones map into the disallowed regions, and the ones that map into the disallowed regions are non-physical. Okay, so you could rule out a certain class of geometries, and you could say that those geometries could never appear as the classical geometry in any kind of consistent theory of quantum gravity whose classical limit is Einstein gravity. So this is all okay. So this is all. Let me restate the assumptions. Okay. So this is all. Okay. So what to make that very general statement? What we're having to believe is that given some consistent theory of quantum gravity, I could use that to define a conformal field theory. Okay, so you may or may not believe that. And the other thing that I'm assuming is that since this theory of quantum gravity has Einstein gravity as its classical limit, that's also an assumption that will be true about some theories but not others. So we're also going to assume that this, in that case, this Ryutaki Nagi formula is the correct way to translate. Okay, so those are the assumptions.
You just explained that there might be, you know, all of the previous hypotheses could be true, but it might be that the states that are expressed in theory do not satisfy this relationship. So this is an extra assumption that maybe is part of your, you know.
No, I mean, okay, so what I'm assuming is that I'm assuming those things are true. So yes, yeah. That was that's the starting point. So the whole talk is basically. Okay. So I'm assuming that in our CFT, a family of states. I don't even have to. Okay. So really, we could start on the gravity side and say we have a state of this gravity theory, which has some well-defined classical geometry. Okay, so we're in the classical limit.
Is that this family of measure zero, is it dense, is it state?
Well, that actually relates to this question. Okay, so if you understand the answer to this question, you'll understand. It's probably a small subset.
Yeah,
but that's fine. I don't care. For this, okay. So that's all related to. Okay. So your question is you know what states could have gravity descriptions? That's exactly related to understanding. You know here we find that if it has a gravity description, it must. Satisfy very special conditions on its entanglement entropy. Okay, so those very special conditions are likely to pick out a very small subset of possible states of the field theory. Okay, so now let's say that I think this will help us answer your question about how many states are there that actually could have a geometrical description. So now I'm saying, let's suppose that we've found one of these states. We suppose there's a state of the field theory that does have a good geometrical description, where I can use this to go back and forth. Okay, what can I say about the geometry? Can I now say something about that geometry by using now these kinds of constraints? Okay, so that's. So yeah, we're working in like this very limited class of states where you do have a good gravity description where
in
this is true.
Sense, but it could be, I mean, whatever, it could be that there exists a gravity description, but it doesn't. It's not expressed by this equation, the correction.
Well,
or there's
Okay.
It could be that there, you know.
I mean, it could be that so this could be this is just wrong.
It could be that there are other.
Yeah, no, as I said, this is what I'm assuming. I mean, I think this is plausibly true. You know, there have been some general arguments for the validity of this, but I won't go into that. Okay. Right. Okay. So how do we go about So again, reviewing, we've got various constraints on entanglements, the structure of entanglement, and I want to basically figure out, assuming that formula, which spacetimes here are going to map into functions on subsets that actually satisfy these, and which spacetimes don't. Okay. So now I could just write down a spacetime, just write down a metric that's asymptotically ADS. And so, okay, I write down some metric. Well, okay. I don't know. Okay, so I write down some metric and some form, and then I just go ahead and now I'm going to consider this region, and this region. And I compute the areas of these extremal surfaces, and then I just check whether this is true or not. And if it's true, then I put a check mark, and then I move on to the next metric, and if it's false, I put an X and I move on to the next metric. Okay, so this is basically what you do, but you try to do it in a more systematic way. Okay. So let me start by. Pardon? No. So yeah. Okay. So that's actually a good. So what we're going to do is basically just rule out or verify certain geometry. I mean, really, we're ruling out certain geometries. Now, if I find a geometry, so say I find a geometry M which is unphysical. Okay. I mean, since we were thinking about theories of quantum gravity whose classical limit is Einstein. Well, this geometry satisfies Einstein's equations for some stress energy tensor. Okay, so if you want to take an additional step, then what you could say is that, well, the fact that M is unphysical in some sense is telling you that whatever stress energy tensor would be required to support that geometry is unphysical. Okay, and so that kind of goes back to the title of the talk, that if you find an unphysical geometry here, and then assuming Einstein's equation, you rule out certain stress energy tensors, that's like an energy condition. So it's like the conditions that people often take as plausible assumptions about energy and general relativity. But here we would actually, here we're basically understanding these conditions based on some kind of fundamental principle. Well, so yeah, I'll tell you more specific things, but Yeah, so I mean, roughly speaking, the claim is that these would rule out a class of geometries, and therefore they would rule out a class of possible stress energy tensors across, you know, whatever theories for whatever theories our assumptions are true about. Okay, so let me talk a little bit. Let me see. Okay, I mean, I think I'll largely now kind of present some of the results of this. So let me first talk about strong subadditivity. Okay. So in general, this is a constraint where I choose like three regions A, B, and C. There's an interesting simplification of this. So if I, you know, in principle, I should have to check, given my metric, I should have to check this strong subadditivity for all possible choices A, B, and C. But it turns out to be sufficient to check the cases where A and C are infinitesimal regions. So if I look at a large region B and infinitesimal regions A and C, I can actually, so if the strong subadditivity constraint is satisfied for all such cases, I can then derive the general thing. So I'll just quickly show you how that works. So if I look at, say, this, the strong subadditivity constraint associated to these three regions, it gives me one inequality. And now I'm going to consider, my region, another constraint where B prime is now this slightly larger region where I've tacked on A. And then I add a little bit more. I'll call this A prime. Okay. So both of these constraints have, you know, one big region and then two little infinitesimal regions. But if I add up the two inequalities for these two cases, what I end up with is exactly the strong subadditivity constraint where for the region B, the region C, and for the region A, which is now the combination of A and A prime. Okay. So using strong subadditivity for these two cases, I actually build up, I've built up a slightly larger region A. And I could then keep doing that such that the set of inequalities for the big region and two infinitesimal regions, I could get up to having kind of an arbitrary region A, the region B, and then an infinitesimal region. And then I could actually do the same thing and end up by just adding up the inequalities to get strong subadditivity for three general regions. Okay. So in yeah, I'm probably a. Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there could be, for this, I don't think I'm assuming any smoothness. I mean, in fact, we know of cases where changing the regions a little bit, you could actually have a jump. You could have so for example, if I consider a region A, which is disjoint, and I separate the parts, it's known that I could have a kink, or so a discontinuity in, say, the derivative with respect to the position of these two regions. So it's not necessarily a smooth function. Yeah.
So you are going to measure and do all this in particular checks of subadditivity at every instance in time, right?
Yes.
But suppose that. Okay, so if my state is evolving, right?
Right.
And I look at the regions which are causally disconnected. So by the time you establish, you know, causal contact between the regions, the evolution took place. And so what I'm asking is, if you put too much emphasis on the strong added subadditivity condition, but you know, it's not clear to me that should hold, in particular if your regions are causally disconnected. And so the whole concept of being able to measure lots of things at the same time is strange.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is a question about some observer going out and checking whether their space-time is consistent. I mean,
but I thought that's what you are trying to do when you check subadditivity, right?
Well, the...
Maybe you measure, you know, intensity of the region, but by the time you measure...
No, I mean, I don't think anyone has to measure anything. It's just, you know, the field theory state is like this vector in some big Hilbert space. And subsets are described by some density matrices, and these matrices, they're things that satisfy basic constraints. If I take a matrix and I trace over part of it, and I get another matrix, and then I trace over another part, and I get another matrix. There are relations that. This is basically some relation where I start with a big matrix and I trace over parts. And this is something to do with the eigenvalues of the matrices that I get in that procedure. So it's really it's not a question of whether I'm going to measure something and violate a physical constraint. It's just that I cannot write down a matrix in a acting on a Hilbert space that violates this. There are no such matrices. Okay, so it's really quite basic.
But also, in your fixed space B, isn't that like a fixed time slice in cosmic space, or is that a space like?
Well, so I've just drawn a slice, but B really represents a space time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so when you have this strong subadditivity constraint, it should well okay. Let me give you a specific example in a minute. Okay, yeah, that's fine. Okay, so just to finish up the thought here, when I write down a metric and I want to check strong subadditivity, okay, so the first thing is that I don't really have to check all possible regions A, B, and C. I just have to check the region. I just have to check the cases where you have one big region and then two infinitesimal regions, and so geometrically, what that's going to translate to is a statement that, okay, so now the entanglement entropy for the big region is computed using this surface B tilde. Okay. And so if I try to check this infinitesimal strong subadditivity constraint, what I'm going to do is now compare that area with the areas of very slightly perturbed surfaces. And so what you would notice is that will just be sensitive to the geometry nearby that original surface. Okay. So the set of strong subadditivity constraints are going to map to a set of geometrical constraints that you know have something to do with these extremal surfaces. Okay. In the example that I'll show you, it's going to be something like an integrated energy condition where we're integrating something like the null energy condition over such a surface. Okay. So let me go directly to that example. I'm just going to talk about 1 plus 1 dimensional theories so I can draw space and time on the board at the same time. And so in that case, when we're talking about this region B, the most general thing so let me consider for now connected regions B. So the most general thing would just be an interval from x1 to some space-like separated point x2. Okay. And so when we're talking about this kind of infinitesimal strong subadditivity constraint that we have to check, so my region A is going to be some infinitesimal region here And my region C is going to be some infinitesimal region here. Let me call that C1, C2. So there's a little vector here and a little vector there. Okay. And so now if I write down my strong subadditivity constraint, it has a nice form. So I write down this constraint. Okay, so this is like S of A union B is just the entanglement entropy of like this interval from this point to this point. Okay. So this is what you get. And then you could rearrange this to be a derivative. So it's so it all boils down to saying that this particular second derivative of this entanglement entropy function has to satisfy this inequality. Okay, and you could even I'm running out of time, but so since this is linear in these vectors C1 and C2, so really I have constraints for all these possible deformations. Okay, so A could be an infinitesimal interval, which is at a constant time, or it could be any kind of space-like interval that I add on. Okay, up to having a null interval. And since this inequality is linear in those in that vector C1, actually what you realize is all you have to check is the case where this one is null. Okay. So if this constraint is satisfied in the case where my interval A is this null interval, and it's satisfied in the case where it's this null interval, then all of the other ones are going to be satisfied as well. Okay. So actually, you end up with a really simple thing to check. All you have to check is that delta, so there's basically four things. Well, okay, I just write them all down. Okay, so to summarize, for this two-dimensional case, if I want to check find out what are the constraints of strong subadditivity, what I have to do is consider these general intervals between space-like separated points x1 and x2. The entanglement entropy is some function of those two points. And then what I have to check is that these derivatives, where I take the derivative with respect to x1 and the derivative with respect to x2 in various null directions, I have to check that those are always negative. Okay. So in this form, it's not so hard to now go and do the calculation in your geometry. Okay, so what I have to do is now take my geometry, consider this extremal surface, which is just a geodesic, calculate, and then see how its area changes as I perturb this endpoint in a null direction and perturb this endpoint in a null direction. Okay, so that's the calculation that I have to do. And the result, okay, so I said it wasn't too hard. So far, we've done that not in complete generality. We've done it in a few special cases. So first of all, it's been done for geometries which are Lorentz invariant in the field theory directions. So these geometries would be dual, actually not necessarily to CFTs, but to RG flows, where you have a CFT in the UV and a CFT in the IR. It's also been done, we've also done this check, or actually originally Rangamani and Hubany and Takinagi and Bhattacharya did this in the case where you have translation invariant geometries which are small perturbations away from ADS. So in a few special symmetric cases, we've actually been able to do this very explicitly and translate that into a statement about the bulk geometry. Okay, so this is kind of the punchline then. So the statement about the bulk geometry that it translates to involves, so if you think about a light sheet coming off this surface, well, it doesn't, okay. So you take your arbitrary spatial geodesic in the bulk, ending on these two points, construct some light sheet. Okay, so, and then consider a bunch of null vectors along this light sheet. Okay, so this is a null vector field along the geodesic with some particular normalization. The constraint then turns out to be that the integral along this geodesic of the stress energy tensor contracted with this null vector field has to be greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so this is exactly what the strong subadditivity constraint translates to, at least in these special cases where we've managed to do the calculations. And conjecturally, maybe this is more general. Okay. So what you realize is this combination of things is exactly what appears in the null energy condition. So it's one of these. So the weak energy condition in GR is a condition that for time-like vectors U, this has to be positive. It's basically the statement that any observer will measure positive energy density. Okay. The null energy condition is the limit where you take those to be light-like. And so if this null energy condition is satisfied, well, then this integrated version will be satisfied and strong subadditivity will be satisfied. But what we see is that strong subadditivity actually doesn't require the full null energy condition. What it requires is only this particular integrated version. Okay. So if you have your space-time and you consider any particular spatial geodesic in the bulk, and you integrate this null energy condition along the entire geodesic, that has to be positive. Okay. And so the claim would be that maybe this is violated sometimes. We don't know. But this can never be violated. Right. Yeah, that's right. So these integrated versions have shown up a bunch in the literature, but typically they're integrated along the a light-like geodesic or a.
It's not exactly the same integrated.
Yeah, so it's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I better stop. Let me just mention, so you can look at the paper. There's another class of constraints that are related to a quantity called relative entropy. Relative entropy is something that compares your state with another reference state, which you could, for example, take to be the vacuum state. And minus trace. Okay. So there's a very general statement. So sigma is some reference density matrix. Rho is the density matrix for your state. These could be reduced density matrices for some region, like we've been talking about. And so the general statement is that this quantity is always positive, and also that if I have like a subsystem, so I say I now reduce to a further density matrix for a subsystem, then the relative entropy for this smaller subsystem is less than or equal to the relative entropy for the the larger one. Okay, so these two properties are positive monotonicity of relative entropy and positivity of relative entropy. So it turns out this is something that, in the case where A is a ball-shaped region, so for special regions, you can give a holographic description of this. And then it gives you some additional constraints. So it's the same deal. You have a metric, and you can compare that metric to the relative entropy kind of compares that metric to the metric of pure ADS. Or in two dimensions, you could actually use general boosted black hole geometries and compute the relative entropy in those cases. So there's another set of constraints there. It seems like they're actually weaker than the strong subadditivity constraints in the cases where we've been able to compare directly. But there are there's some interesting things where, in one case, the positivity of relative entropy directly gave a version of the weak energy condition.
Also iterated, or?
Pardon?
Iterated as well.
Well, so in that case, okay, so I'll just state that result. So we were looking at the positivity of relative entropy, and we actually just focused on the constraints on the asymptotic metric, so just the metric near the boundary. And then in that case, it gave kind of a local condition that was equivalent to the weak energy condition applied to observers traveling parallel to the boundary. Okay. So positivity of relevant entropy told us that if you're an observer in the asymptotic region and you're traveling at any velocity parallel to the boundary, then you're going to see positive energy. I'll refer you to the paper for these relative entropy constraints, but I should stop there. Yeah.
The Buddhist constraint is also about the asymptotic metric. You're talking about the TMU of the metric near the boundary.
No. Yeah, so that was, yeah, so so the context in which we've actually derived that is we're assuming some symmetry. Okay, so say translation invariant, the simplest case would be Lorentz invariant geometry. So I have f of r dr plus r squared. Okay, so this class of geometries. But we don't make any further restrictions on F, okay? And so in that case, these spatial geodesics that I talk about can extend arbitrarily far into the bulk, okay? And we find that you have to have this satisfied on all of those, yeah. So it's not really, it's not restricted close to the boundary. Pardon?
U was a vector on the boundary.
No. So U is a vector field that. So there's a light sheet coming from that geodesic. And then U is defined along that curve.
I have something that could be an unfair question, but let me just ask it.
Yeah.
So isn't this, in a way, do you think this is as good as it can get? Because in a sense, it's very interesting that you get this condition coming out naturally. On the other hand, by choosing point x1 and x2, there's quite a bit of region in the bulk. So I can definitely imagine engineering a TMU that makes absolutely no sense here, as far as if I work with a ball lines equations in that regime, I would have closed under curves and all sort of nonsense. But on the iterated line, I would have something that would satisfy the condition.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, but the thing is, you have to, okay, so you've got your bulk metric or your bulk TMU nu. And all of these conditions have to hold at once. So you must satisfy. So you should check all of the possible geodesics. There's this huge family of curves that densely cover the bulk, and the stress energy tensor has to integrate to be positive on all of those. Okay, so it's possible that it could be negative at some point. I mean, you might hope that, well, with all that information, it must be positive everywhere. It's not true. You can find examples where it's negative in some little region, and yet it still integrates to be positive over all the curves. So it doesn't give you complete flexibility to write down nonsense. Yeah.
There are theories that would violate the null energy condition that one might be interested in seeing whether they have duals. But presumably, maybe they don't violate this integrated version of it. Do you have like an example of some theory that somebody might be interested in that would violate this integrated version?
Yeah. So I mean, I haven't spent much time looking. I guess the context that people are invoking energy conditions, it's usually not in asymptotically ADS geometries. In cosmology, when someone's trying to come up with a new alternative to inflation or something, and inventing some crazy fields that are sourcing the metric, then that would be a situation where sometimes people are violating energy conditions. But directly what you could apply this to would just be asymptotically ADS. Now you could take this as a hint that so I could state like this statement that the null energy condition integrated over spatial geodesics is positive. I mean, that could turn out to be a more general constraint. So I guess you could take that kind of condition and ask whether it's satisfied for, say, theories that people are working with in cosmology. But so far, I couldn't directly argue, say, using strong subadditivity, that in a cosmological setting that those energy conditions would have to be satisfied. Yeah.
What about the theories that are not in one plus one dimension? What is the conjecture?
Yeah, so that's something we're working on now. Roughly speaking, again, I can formally write down what the strong subadditivity constraint leads to. So again, you start with some extremal surface, any extremal surface in the bulk, and the strong subadditivity constraint, it constrains, so you perturb the boundary of this region over here, and the constraint, it actually constrains how some other point on the boundary will respond to that. So I could express this as some constraint on I guess a response function that's related to these extremal surfaces. So if I perturb it here and look at how it changes there, then there's something, some condition that has to hold if strong subadditivity is going to be true. And I suspect that will translate into a condition that's integrated over the entire region. I mean, it would be nice if it turned out to be as simple as this. So it could be that the answer is that you look at some null vectors coming off of this extremal surface, and then you just integrate the null energy condition over that surface. But I'm not really sure how to show that yet.
In this explicit computations that you did, what conditions on that for far did you impose? So it can be a completely arbitrary. I mean, where do you really require ADSness?
Well, we did require asymptotic ADSness. Otherwise you don't necessarily even have a boundary.
But other than the asymptotic behavior of that,
yeah, we didn't really place any constraints. So, we may have assumed that it's smooth somewhere, but I don't. Yeah, and the, I mean, the case we looked at, the whole geometry has this Lorentz invariance. So it's I suspect in this two-dimensional case, we may be able to get this type of thing generally, even if it's not static. So we're working on that.